started off in ad tech. I was actually fighting Russian bots, my first job out of grad school. So I have some context for these adversarial games that we may soon see in AI.
Welcome to Inside Scoop with Sean Emery. Every week we are examining something new, bringing you closer to companies, sectors, and themes. This recording should not be construed as a substitute for personalized individual advice from Avery & Company or any guest on the show. This is for educational purposes only and not intended to make an offer or solicitation for any companies or securities mentioned. With that, let's get on with the episode. All right. Welcome to Inside Scoop. We are here with Soren Larson from Crosshatch. He is focused on personalized AI, another AI company we're bringing on to the podcast to give us some perspective, honestly, what's really going on out there in terms of use case and functionality and utility. We're so happy to have you here. You're actually here in Miami. We're here in Miami. We're still doing this digitally, which says a lot about, you know, all the digital tools that have, you know, come to existence over the last, you know, 3 to 5 years. But with that, you know, welcome to Inside Scoop.
Thanks very much. Really cool to be here.
Yeah. So you obviously have a fascinating background. You know, you were the head of, you know, our chief data scientist at, you know, Consumer Edge and, you know, at Walmart, also, you know, a director on computer science and some other, you know, companies that you were at. Now you have Crosshatch, which seems very, very interesting. You know, I was put in touch with you by someone else also, you know, focused on personalized AI. I think it's an interesting area. Would love to have you kind of peel back that onion. But before that, if you could, you know, just tell us a little bit about yourself, your background. I spilled some of it, but however you want to frame.
Definitely. Yeah. My background's in pure and applied math. Studied economics and math in undergrad. Studied applied math at Harvard. I've worked in New York tech. I sort of grew up in New York tech. I started off in ad tech. I was actually fighting Russian bots. My first job out of grad school. So I have some context for these adversarial games that we may soon see in AI. I ended up working at Consumer Edge. We launched a preeminent consumer spending insights data product to all the top hedge funds, everybody you can imagine. So good context for how, for example, privacy mechanisms unlock access to exercising data, for example, in financial markets. And then interestingly, I worked on personalization at Walmart, of all places. I ended up working for a former quant from Renaissance Technologies, who interestingly had joined Walmart. A lot of people don't know, but Walmart's interesting for a variety of reasons. It's a massive company, but there is a Walmart store within 10 miles of 90% of all Americans. And further, you know, Walmart is a grocery business, so it's the consumer staples business. Like these facts combined, like Walmart customers are shopping at Walmart quite frequently. And so when you think about companies who have great data assets, Walmart should be at the top of your list. And so Walmart is very well positioned to use its data assets, for example, for personalization. And so I had a front row seat in terms of how a corporate who has amazing data is thinking about personalization. I can pause there.
I mean, I could go down a whole rabbit hole with Walmart just trying to figure that out. But the, you know, in general, you have a thesis here, right? Really around personalized AI. Would love to hear, you know, what has now led you to Crosshatch and founding it and believing in this mission. If you could just describe the mission, I guess, and then, you know, what has really led to this moment in time for you guys?
Yeah, I think so. Our mission is simple and maybe audacious, but we're interested in hyper-personalizing the internet in a safe way. There are a few things that can motivate this and sort of motivate this, sort of the components of this, the hyper-personalization and the safety of it. I think on the hyper-personalization side, we just sort of look at the history of personalization. You know, say like the mass market catalogs of, say Sears, for example, where personalization was provided just by providing a catalog of everything. You know, anyone gets a Sears catalog and you'll be able to find something you like. Now you have to go find it. We started to see, you know, from there, I think, you know, I guess maybe perhaps the 1970s, we started to see a little bit more personalization. People would create like these psychographic profiles of consumers. Coca-Cola would launch Diet Coke to target a product to a specific segment of customers. We later saw, for example, Amex with its loyalty program starting to develop profiles. So Amex, I think, was one of the first to develop a CRM so that it could actually track customer customer spending and provide a more personalized experience to cardholders. And then, of course, I don't have to tell you about recent history. Facebook and TikTok have delivered to us sort of, I think, the personalization we expect today, where sort of our collective interactions drive experiences that delight, where interfaces are designed specifically to collect information that powers this personalization that many folks love. And so our mission is in hyper-personalization. And perhaps you could say, like, one way to think about it could be delivering the sorts of personalization that people have come to expect on a TikTok or a Snap, but everywhere. Maybe a nice way to imagine it is, especially in the age of AI, where it seems agents, for example, are on the horizon. You can look to Bill Gates' writing on this, for example. I think it's fair to expect that a Jarvis, say, of Tony Stark, the sort of personalized engagement should be available on any surface we wish. Anyone we wish to engage with should be able to engage with us like a Jarvis. But today, the data that could make this possible is not available. Companies don't have enough data to deliver this Jarvis on surfaces that they own. And at the same time, consumers feel like personalization on the internet is a little creepy today. We feel, you know, your dad or moms will say, you know, maybe say something and then Instagram will show an ad. People will ask, well, is it listening to me? How does it know this? And still, people are asking these questions. So the internet also, so at the same time, while, you know, companies don't have enough data to deliver this sort of Jarvis-like experience, people are also feeling sort of creeped out. And so our mission is to deliver sort of this Jarvis-like experience, but in a chill way, in a way that where people feel safe and in control, but get this Jarvis that I think we deserve of the future.
Got it. So there's really going to the mission here. There's two things that have, one that has changed, one that at the infrastructure layer, I mean the tech stack. You have generative AI. So my question there is, is that what has given you the aha moment to really go after this? That's number one. Number two, you mentioned how many of the companies don't have the data, I guess, accessible here. What has to change there as well? So it's really these potentially two unlocks where you can take the data, personalize it, or read it, and you know, have output. Yeah. So really those two things, because that seems super important to the overarching story of personalization. It's the models that can train and understand and then put output. And then two is, you know, having access to that data. So what do you see today on that data side that needs to change or evolve? And then was generative AI the aha moment, or, you know, were you already on that path?
Yeah, that's great. Interesting questions. I think maybe one place to start looking is just at the demise of third-party cookies. So Google has been pushing for a while to deprecate third-party cookies, to make it impossible for sites to track consumer behavior across other sites. I think I just saw in the news that maybe Google is going to actually delay for a third time the deprecation of third-party cookies. But there is this general trend right now of people sort of like, and I think it seems entirely mostly propagated by business, but also you could say that like legally, like the EU, California, and I think even maybe from the Biden administration, interest in privacy and control. So I think, I don't know, certainly, the dynamics around privacy and control, these growing interests in control, and these changes both in industry and in government, I think are a spark, if you will. If it's true that third-party cookies are deprecating and they were a source of context for websites and they're going away, like how the heck is any of this going to work? And then I think just the observation, you know, at Walmart, I was able to see what data a huge corporate like Walmart has access to. And my observation was that I guess as a data scientist there, I was disappointed with the amount of data that we had access to, even though Walmart had access to. So I think like just these observations of sort of privacy, perhaps these I think well-motivated privacy and control interests sort of encroaching upon businesses' ability to wield contextual details about consumers. And at the same time, observing one of the best endowed companies and their available data assets and feeling a little disappointed, that was sort of a spark of, well, if a Walmart is even challenged in its ability to ship personalization, what is everyone else going to do? And so I think that was one motivation. On the generative AI side, I really like how folks at New Computer like have spoken about generative AI. They refer to it, I think classically, and making sort of a pop culture reference, as generative AI is everything everywhere all at once. It's a means to take just a simple reference to something and with just a very simple instruction, convert it into anything else. It's quite extraordinary. And I think, and I've seen sort of the CTO, I believe, Sam at New Computer, refer to Gen AI as just a sort of a magical ETL, just to, it can magically transform some content into something else, just with some simple instruction. It's quite extraordinary. And in that way, you know, you can think of personalization in some ways as a realization of such an exercise. You know a little something, you have some instructions on what you might wish to do with that something. And personalization could come by combining, you know, something you have as a business. So you have some inventory you might wish to sell. You have, some advice that you might wish to share with the consumer, and you might have a little bit of information about them. And generative AI makes the shipping of personalized experiences, the transformation of contextual details about a consumer and the context within which they're engaging with you, as a means to deliver personalization. So it can make the development of personalization cheaper, because no longer do you require perhaps all this training data about consumer behavior, conversions, site tracking. We'll still need this, but it seems quite possible, you know, apparent that we can actually ship personalization zero shot. We can just declare, hey, here's some information about a consumer. Use it to predict what they might like. Like, that could be a valid form of personalization. And so that's one exciting interface into CrossApps. So we're excited about a number of them.
Yeah, I suppose. Now the data side still sounds like, you know, if Walmart can't do it, you know, fine tune in, and they have data silos everywhere, and really combining that, like, how is, like, I guess maybe tilt to your product, and then I'll follow up with the follow-up question around data, maybe how you're making it easier for somebody that has these data silos and or doesn't have data yet. And obviously just depending on the size of these institutions. Talk about CrossHatch, like, what are you doing? How is it being embedded? What's the output of, like, you know, a user that would be using maybe, you know, one of your customers in the future?
So CrossHatch is a personal data wallet that allows consumers to share and unshare their data to applications that they love for a tailored to you experience. So how does this work? Consumers go to a site that they that's delivering a more personalized experience. So say booking.com. They go to booking.com, says, hey, Sean, we're shipping a hyper-personalized experience, and we are delivering that to you via CrossHatch. You click on connect with CrossHatch. Booking.com via CrossHatch invites you to connect data that could be useful to this personalized experience that they've built. So they might invite you to connect your credit card data, because your credit card data has quite rich signal into things that you like. You know, following economics parlance, it's revealed preference. But you've actually spent money on these things, so it can actually indicate real interest. You might wish to connect your calendar information, so Booking.com knows when you're free for a trip. You might wish to connect your Gmail data, because Gmail has information to the restaurants that you've reserved on OpenTable. And through these connections, Booking.com is able to deliver this hyper-personalized experience, because they're able to safely reference these details about you. And you could say, you might just then ask, well, so why is CrossHatch even involved? Like, ostensibly, Booking.com could ship these integrations themselves. There are two reasons. One, our mission in some ways is to make data sharing chill. Like what I've just described, connecting your credit card, like, your credit card, your it might sound extraordinary. I'm not going to connect my credit card to somebody I don't know. That's crazy. Sure. Why would I do that?
I get it actually right away. Right when you said it, I get what you're trying to do already. And like, you know, you don't want to have to do that at every institution you're going to. So having this wallet that is portable with you that you can do on an as needed basis, but also maybe govern it. I don't know. Is that part of it as well? Where like you have an admin portal for yourself that says, hey, I'm connected to Bookings. I don't want to give it to Bookings anymore.
That's right.
Cool. Keep going.
Yeah. So for example, in this like little blurb, I noted that you can share and unshare your data. It's a very interesting property, one that we're interested in developing further, where we sort of have a first form of this that we expect to expand. But when you connect your data to CrossHatch, you connect it to your personal vaults. And that raw data that's connected is yours alone. If you wish to delete it, you can. Like our only interest, our whole mission is in service of consumers. And I guess you could say, and businesses who are then can deliver personalized experiences. On top of this data, we develop representations of it. For example, inside of your Gmail are references to, hey, maybe you made a reservation on OpenTable. We create a representation of this reservation that can be readily referenced by businesses. So when a business says, hey, Sean, could you share your Gmail so we know like what sort of restaurants you like? You're not actually sharing with CrossHatch your underlying Gmail data to booking.com. You're just sharing information about reservations you made. That's pretty reasonable. Like, yeah, of course, I'll share my reservations. That could help me find new restaurants. But our view is that you shouldn't have to share, you know, your private personal email with, you know, with every, you know, and indeed our expectation is that, you know, AI and the companies who are building AI are making it increasingly easy to build incredible new experiences. But a blocker to this is how do you reference information about your consumers that can prove powerful, for example, as administered or deployed by AI. And so if there's this chill way for a developer to say, hey, we just want to reservate your recent restaurant reservations, or hey, we just want to know what gyms you like to go to, or what parks you've been to recently. Like that's a pretty reasonable ask. But today there's no means to do it. It's all or nothing. You can either make a copy of your entire inbox or all of your credit card transactions or all of your Instagram photos, all of your photos to somebody you don't know, or you don't get access at all. Like that's basically how the internet has worked. The internet, at least for the last 15 years, you know, maybe I'm relatively young, but has operated over, you know, what I think what lawyers refer to as adhesion contracts. They say you can either agree to our terms and operate, do business how we do business, or you don't get access at all. Our interest is in fine-tuning that relationship so that developers and businesses can just ask for what they need. And they can tell consumers, hey, we're just asking for this because we're trying to deliver this cool experience. And consumers can rest assured that when they share data, they're just sharing the data that just powers this experience. And it's only going to be used for the purpose that was specified. And so we think that mechanism is actually going to unlock a much deeper sharing because data sharing is kind of chill. It's not a big deal.
Got it. No, there's a lot to unpack there. So number one, you've referenced the term chill a couple times or multiple times. That's obviously strategic here. Is it because, you know, data can be a little bit overwhelming and the thought of it in terms of, you know, providing that to third parties? Or, you know, I'm being hyper specific here in terms of the word choice, just trying to understand the why, yeah. I guess, behind the term chill. Is it because, again, data, privacy, security, all of that is, you know, intense and you're trying to kind of remove some of that general friction of saying, hey, you know, here's CrossHatch. They're serious, but at the same time, you know, this allows you to open up, you know, further avenues of call it commerce or whatever other avenues you go into.
I think our interest is into disentangle the seriousness of a data source and the signal or the signals that it can often contain. So you, on one hand, someone asks, hey, share your Gmail for this service. Sounds pretty intense. Like you're going to access all my emails. That's pretty intense. I don't know if I trust that. On the other hand, if someone's just saying, hey, I just want to know where you went, like your recent restaurant reservations. That's pretty reasonable. And there are a few candidate data sources that could provide it. Some of which are easier to access than others. Email can be, it's a sort of a common one that we all have. But right now it's not like data sharing is not chill because the only way to expose that information is to copy your inbox. That's crazy. But if you didn't have to copy your inbox, you could just copy the detail, just they were effortless to just copy the little details that matter to a given use case, to a given context. That's a whole different offer. I guess I can note too, there's a growing set of privacy laws, both as propagated by Europe and in America. For example, the Biden administration released an executive order on AI that included a clause around privacy. It seems like there's growing interest across America to see more states enact privacy laws. Maybe we'll see a federal privacy law. All these privacy laws are in some ways, tech folks can maybe be allergic to regulation, but the norms espoused by these laws feel pretty reasonable. They basically say, you know, if you ask a consumer for some information, you should tell them why you're asking. And you should just like be nice and like only use the data for the reason you asked them. And if you need it to use it for another reason, just ask them again. It's pretty reasonable. And I think it corresponds with like how we just as people understand sort of sharing information as a function of the context that we're in. You know, this conversation, you know, has a specific context and we share a certain information corresponding to this context. Whereas, you know, with our, you know, our close friends, we might share different information, and that's all governed by the context. But sort of the elephant in the room of I think the internet of the last 15 years or so has been that context has been abused and overloaded and stretched. It's been sort of like, we're going to like share your information for this, you know, for the provision of this service. And it turns out that the service is actually quite wide ranging, can be used. You know, we've seen classical cases of, I think it was Facetune that, you know, said, oh, can, you know, share pictures of yourself, but actually those photos might've been shared, with certain foreign governments. We've seen cases of, dating profiles, photos from dating profiles being used to train facial recognition algorithms. Like, our trust and the context within which we've shared information has been abused. Like, it just has been. But if there were a way that we could know that it's not going to be, that sharing is like actually not a big deal because, you know, it's constrained, that could make it chill. And as a result, scale it.
Got it. Cool. Yeah, no, it reminds me of, you know, payments 1.0, 2.0, identity 1.0, 2.0, meaning like, you know, I think of like Cash App, right? Where they applied like a cultural relevance to money. And, you know, now they have 55 million users, right, across the board there. And it was kind of this, again, you have your payment wallet, you have credit cards inside, but it was like, you know, a cool thing to have. And they added culture around something that is pretty serious. Now, and then there's identity with like Clear, Secure, and, you know, their gateway in is, you know, getting you at the airport and then potentially taking identity beyond that. Now, I think of personalization, which is like the data, which is really, really important. You know, I think it's somewhat abstract to some people, right? Because we're just touching so many things all day. But all that is being collected. I mean, the data that you would be harnessing. We've talked a lot about that, right? What you're going to try to achieve from kind of your infrastructure side. Beyond that, what are we going to see, I guess, from, let's say, our consumption, right? If I'm going on, I don't know, again, walmart.com, let's say they were a customer eventually, and you went to, you know, walmart.com, how do you envision, you know, that product being in the wild?
Definitely. Yeah. So we're, in some ways, you could say we're building the identity layer for personalization. Today, and I think it's sort of, you can sort of see people walking toward this future. For example, Expedia shipped Expedia GPT. Expedia is encouraging folks to log in with one key. So Expedia can develop an identity and start better tracking sort of what people like and sort of delivering better personalization. Today, most users on the internet are anonymous. They're not logged in. Cookies are going to make it harder. Both cookies and the demise of cookies and the actions of Apple, for example, are making it more and more difficult to even track an IP address. And IP addresses are not a specific indicator of a given device or user. It's just going to make it very difficult for businesses to create digital interfaces that correspond to individual consumers. And so even if we were to assume those problems away, where Walmart was able to, you know, is able to identify a specific user and associate past actions, in Walmart, as I mentioned, Walmart is well positioned in the sense that it's a consumer staples business. People are transacting. But actually I can share, and it's interesting. Well, so even though Walmart is so important, like Walmart still doesn't observe all grocery transactions, for example. Like if they did, they'd probably be able to, you know, do a pretty good job of predicting what you need because they know what's in your fridge, basically. But today Walmart just operates on clickstream data. They just operate on sort of what they've observed you click around. And we collectively as machine learning folks have been last decade have been attempting to infer preference on the basis of pretty weak signal. We look at clickstream, you know, I think if we zoomed out and just started thinking about like, what specifically are we doing with clickstream and conversions data? Like we're really saying, oh, because somebody clicked on, you know, this specific sequence of products, that means that they are like this other person who actually did this one thing. It feels a little tenuous. Like I'm not saying it doesn't work because it clearly works, to an extent. But it's a little tenuous. It's like, do our clicks really represent what we need? Maybe. On the other hand, do like actual signals of our purchases, our behaviors, where it's not, we're not making inferences to what we like, but we can actually just observe, a business can actually just observe what we like, what we've spent money on, our aesthetic preferences. If they can just observe that, what could our digital experiences become? So instead of, you know, just sorting items based on, you know, like a few clicks on that Walmart might observe on a site, Walmart could invoke this crosshatch identity and entirely morph itself to this person. It can know that you are a father of a family of four and you are going on a vacation soon. And you've previously purchased these things from other sites and actually serve the person who's decided because they like the service from Walmart that they're going to connect some data in a safe and, you know, by a crosshatch in a safe way. So I see entirely new digital experiences. But that's only possible if context can be shared in a safe way.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting to think about, you know, so like you would love to have Walmart's data inside of that repository, right? And in terms of that being shared in there. Now, if you're Walmart though, wouldn't you, be hesitant to do that because you already have the most data, right? So you're essentially giving your trust, war chest to everybody else. And again, you know, there's balance of power there that is required. But you could say the same thing, you know, Shopify exists, you know, and has done a really, really good job at taking the micro to then mid to then, you know, enterprise merchant and moving that direction and then having, you know, power to the point where, you know, Shopify now has, you know, partnerships with some of the bigger players out there that didn't exist years ago. So obviously, if you execute, you know, you earn it. You earn the right to sit at the table and, you know, they have to, they're kind of semi-forced to be part of the ecosystem as well. What's your thoughts on that in terms of having enough density of the bigger players to want to get involved, just given they have, you know, bigger data pools than,
definitely,
you know, it's a, yeah.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the place, what I think about this problem, the place I always return to is just the consumer. Like, we are not a privacy company per se. We're like sort of a transparency and control company. Walmart, I mean, our position is, you know, when you go shop at Walmart, some data is created. Walmart knows what items you bought. You know, hopefully, what, you know, if you didn't pay in cash, for example,
sure,
you bought online and you logged in, they know what you bought. And that feels like a fair trade. You know, Walmart's collecting this information. They can hopefully, because they have this information, they can hopefully provide a better experience to you. But what's also clear is that, you know, from all these laws, the CCPA, GDPR, and this growing set of privacy laws, is that all of these laws have a clause that say, you know, consumer data ought to be portable. And when it's portable, consumers ought to be able to like immediately use it. The data ought to be in a form that consumers can readily use. The law is clear. And it's pretty, it feels pretty reasonable. It's like, hey, you also were party to this transaction as a consumer. Like you should, it, like you should be able to use the data too. It's not just owned by the company.
Right.
So our position is not that we need to do a deal with, you know, with
big ones.
With rather, I feel like we are simply an agent of, or we wish to be, you know, if we're honored to be an agent of the consumer to get help them have a better experience on the internet. I mean, I guess in sort of philosophically, we can say data moats are. Look, I mean, if you look at the law, it's not clear that data moats are supposed to exist. You know, consumer data is ostensibly owned by all of us because, you know, we were part of like this. Like, I mean, even putting norms aside, like it seems like that's what the law seems to say. and it, if it turns out that this could actually unlock a much better experience on the internet for all of us, that seems like something we should all be able to get behind.
Sure. Yeah. So switching gears real quick. So I get it. I get the, you know, what's being built here. It seems like, you know, a lot of value can be created for a lot of people that are involved in the transactions and just like, I mean, transactions or not, it could be just anything, right? And this goes beyond just, I guess, you know, buy and sell product. AI in general, you know, you're out there in the world. What's the funding environment like? What does it feel like? You've seen a lot of other stuff at other, you know, stops, you know, in general, like what is pretty quickly, what's your views on, you know, what the environment looks and feels like?
Yeah, I think AI is very exciting, very hot. I think that people are starting to get a little bit more real about the businesses that are involved in AI. Personally, I really, for what it's worth, I really like the writing of the guys at Slow Ventures. I think they're, I feel like they're on it. they're cautious about the businesses directly involved in AI. But it does, it sure seems, and I don't think I have that much gray hair, that this is a very exciting time. It seems like, you know, this is of like a web, sort of a web, like the dot, it feels like it could feel like a .com sort of moment.
Yeah.
Hopefully not with a bubble.
Sure. There'll be a bubble somewhere. Yeah. It's just, I think the magnitude of the change is pretty big. And I think we've all touched and felt it. And, you know, if you start to think about, you know, again, there's layers to this stuff, right? And we talked about it at the beginning, which is, you know, compute. Do you have the language models to even, you know, have AI? That's for generative AI, but, you know, other forms of AI. Then you have, you know, do you have access to the data? You know, is the cost of this stuff, you know, getting cheaper or you know, plateauing? And it's clearly getting cheaper if you saw the OpenAI event. And, you know, and then as everything becomes, you know, more, I guess, refreshed on the back end from a tech stack, you know, plug and play with APIs and some other stuff becomes easy. And you kind of have this compounding effect where, you know, it starts to get more and more into our daily lives. So anyways, that's how I feel about it personally, just in general, in terms of kind of what you just mentioned in terms of the magnitude of the change. You obviously chose Miami. You know, I was born and raised here. What was the rationale behind here versus call it, let's say, other locations? And, you know, has that talent pool been, or, you know, are you taking that hybrid, you know, semi-remote strategy where you get people, you know, on the West Coast, East Coast, you know, international, you know, what's your views around Miami and the ecosystems you want to be a part of?
Definitely. So I just moved to Miami, so I appreciate maybe your implicit hospitality. I love Miami. I think Miami has an odd rap. I've seen people say, oh, well, I don't know how you could focus here. I've also seen people who live here say, I mean, I think, you know, say that they grind more in Miami than they do anywhere else. I think maybe one reason Miami is confusing is because it's a bit of absolutely every, I mean, you probably know better than I do, but from my observations of it, I think like one anecdote that's funny is, you know, I've seen, so I tend to wake up pretty early. I see runners at, you know, 5:36 in the morning running from the beach onto, you know, close to Edgewater, you know, to sort of main Miami, like running into people who are leaving the club space. And it's all going on at once. It's just all, this is, that's because incredible. Miami is very beautiful. And so of course you might wish to go running early in the morning, but also it's a good place to party. I think people just imagine that Miami is only about partying, and it's not. I think just on the talent side, I am pumped for like Millennium, Citadel are all moving here. Like New York is decamping. I'm declaring it sure seems like it. at the same time, New Yorkers are not really in the office. Offices in Vidi, they're like, not only are they not fully rented, they're like half rented, but people aren't even in the office on a Thursday afternoon. The last anecdote I'll share, I'll keep this short, is New York used to be the city that never slept. I'm saying used to be. And one perhaps piece of evidence of this is that the reservation that was hardest to get in the city was like at 8:30 p.m. It's impossible to get in any place at 8:30. Now, according to the New York Times, the hardest to get reservation is 6 p.m. Like, are people working? How are you getting out of your, like, what is going on? At the same time, in Miami, the hardest to get rest, like, clearly the best time to be at a restaurant, or at least the, like, when the most and the most beautiful people, is like 9 o'clock. So Miami is taking on.
He's the data science guy, so he knows.
Yeah. I just. My sense is that New York is becoming the suburbs. It's becoming a place where you take meetings. It's not a place you live. Miami is the place to build. So I'm pumped to be here.
That's cool, man. I'm glad. I'm happy to hear that. Obviously, I'm born and raised here, so I'm hyper-biased. But I do think, you know, the energy that's – it's been waves pre-COVID as well. You know, there was a bunch of waves. You know, if you saw Brickell 15 years ago, you wouldn't even, you know, it wouldn't even ring a bell in terms of like what it is today. And then, you know, blocks over and then, you know, over the bridges and things like that. It's all just changed. You know, obviously, you know, we're running up on here. I wanted to give a last chance for you to, you know, mention anywhere to find you, you know, whether it's, you know, anything you want to share, you know, as much as you want to share to find you, what you guys are building, where they can find more. And then we'll wrap it there.
Cool. Yeah. You can check us out at crosshatch.io. We'll probably be out and about in, probably in New York and, certainly in December, and probably, someone in our team is usually up in New York, probably, you know, once a month or so. But you can also come down and find us in Miami.
If I'm running or walking home, it just depends. Cool, man. Well, Soren, I appreciate it, man. Coming on here. Very exciting what you guys are doing. I think, you know, the identity, the digital wallet for, you know, data and identity and personalization makes a ton of sense. It's obviously execution, and obviously wish you best of luck. And we'll probably have you on in the future and get an update. So cool. Thanks for coming on.